I want to direct your attention, if you will, to Judges chapter 7. We're continuing our study on Bible battles. This wasn't one we originally were going to cover, but we, Lord willing, are going to cover this tonight and look forward to sharing this with you. And it's an unusual one, and it just reminds us of this truth, which is kind of right there and you see in front of you. The battle belongs to the Lord, and the battle is the Lord's, and we need to just recognize that. Now, it's a very particular lesson that Gideon is going to learn, and it's a lesson that the story of Gideon is included in the Bible so that you and I will learn it. And I'll also say this, it's one of those lessons that we need to relearn and relearn. We need constant reminding of. So I think you'll find this very, very practical tonight as we walk along with Gideon in this story. And I'm going to give you a little ramp up to where we are just so you can kind of fit this into the context of what is going on. So if you want to just turn back one chapter, and we'll just see a little bit from chapter 6, and then we'll get to the actual battle in chapter 7. It says in 6:1, then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. Never a good thing, right? So the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel because of the Midianites. The children of Israel made for themselves the dens and caves and strongholds which are in the mountains. And it was, whenever Israel had sown, Midianites would come up also, Amalekites and the people of the east would come up against them. And they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep or ox or donkey. And so you can kind of see what's going on there. These people would come at harvest time and just sort of to keep them in subjection, either steal their stuff or destroy their stuff, their food. So Israel was left at a real disadvantage. It tells us exactly why this happened, and this is a repetitive thing you see in the book of Judges. They get into trouble, they forget about the Lord, and then they cry out to the Lord, and God then sends them a judge or a deliverer to come and step into the scene. That's the setup for Gideon. At the end of this section, which goes all the way through verse 10, God sends them a prophet, unnamed. When they cried out to him, which is in verse 6, they repented, cried out to him, and an unnamed prophet comes and tells them that just as I delivered, verse 9, I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, now the hand of those who oppressed you, and drove them out before you and gave you their land. And I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites and those in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice. So God is dealing with why they are there, and then God is about to send a deliverer by the name of Gideon. Gideon was hiding, as it were. He was hiding in an olive press, a place where that was done, sort of kind of a secluded hiding place, trying to thresh out his grain there. An angel shows up to him and shows him strength. And it's interesting that when the angel shows up, he calls him a mighty man of valor. Gideon was anything but a mighty man of valor. About 10 years ago, I shared a series on Sunday night about the life of Gideon, and I subtitled that series, An Unlikely Hero, because certainly he was. So then you have the story where God tells him that he's going to be the deliverer. He starts out by destroying an altar of Baal that his father had, which is interesting. He starts kind of at home cleaning up things and that sort of thing. Then you have in verse 36 to the end of the chapter, the story of the fleece, which is one of the more commonly referred to stories in the life of Gideon. He puts out a fleece, and he does it both ways. One time he wants the ground to be wet, then the fleece dry, then reversed, and to God to confirm that. Then you come to chapter 7. It's time to get serious. Verse 1, chapter 7. Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, he was known by either name. We know him more commonly as Gideon, obviously. And the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the well of Harod, so that the camp of the Midianites was on the other side of them by the hill of Morah, in the valley. Just a little geography, if you're familiar, and if you want to sometime check out your book of maps in the back of your Bible, that would be helpful. But this was a hill that overlooks the Jezreel Valley. Megiddo is one of the principal cities there. It's this long valley. And by the way, I think you're going to cover it as one of the battles. The valley of Megiddo is also Har Megiddo or Harmageddon or Armageddon, where the final battle will be fought. This great vast plain, that's where they were. And they come to this place that's known as the, as he says there, Harod, and they were on the north side of them by the hill of Moriah in the valley. So basically there's this very tall hill, and they're on the other side from where the Midianites are. And he's gathering his troops there to defend them, because once again the Midianites have come and they're going to try to do their thing. And the Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands." And the end of verse number 2 is the key to this whole story, I'm convinced. He says this, let me read the whole verse again. "The Lord said to Gideon, 'The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, mine own hand has saved me.'" He wants to make sure that everybody understands that this is a God victory. This is a God thing. This is God delivering. He's going to do it through the hand of Gideon, those who were with him at that particular time. But he doesn't want them to take credit for it and to claim the victory for themselves. Now, there's another little key later in this chapter. You'll be listening for it, and we're going to kind of give Gideon a grade how he does with that, okay? Now, there's a victory coming, but just remember, God needs to receive the glory and the glory alone. So here's what he says in verse 3. "Now, therefore, proclaim in the hearing..." By the way, before I read that, how would you feel? You're going to go into battle. He's already been a man that's proved he's not exactly the bravest guy on the block. He's had some fears. That's the reason he asked for a sign. That's the reason he's kind of timid. But he says, by the way, the people that you have with you are too many for me to give you the victory. I would imagine, even though we're going to see the number in just a moment, how many he had, I think you would always feel going into the battle, I would like to have too many. Too many sounds like a good thing to have. Could I have some more many in addition to my too many? But God says, no, no, no. So he's already, God's setting this up. Now, verse 3. "Now, therefore, proclaim in the hearing of my people, saying, whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead. And 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained." Suddenly, basically, 2/3 of his army just vanishes. For no other reason. You want to go home? Go home. And 2/3 of them went home. If you're afraid, you're worried about this sort of thing, you're fearful, just go. So God has already whittled this down to a slim minority of the whole. Remember, why is he doing this? He's doing this, what's it says in verse 2? "Lest Israel claim glory for itself against me." He's wanting to make sure that God is going to receive the victory. Now, I'm going to share some principles later, so there'll be some things on the screen. Before we get there, I want you to think with me about this. Sometimes we have situations that come into our lives where it seems very big, very scary, very overwhelming. Don't know if I can get through. I don't know if I can handle this. And I just wonder if sometimes that is the setup for God saying to us, maybe not in as direct terms as he says to Gideon, but God saying to us, I've set this up so you will know when we're through all this that it's God that gives the victory, not you. And one of the lessons we need to learn is not relying on ourselves, but be focused on His victory. I'll just start with this idea. In order to experience God's victory, we must move away from self-focus to a God-focused life. And it's focusing on Him that takes us to say, this is God's doing. This is the setup. And I wonder, I don't have an answer if this is true or not. This is just a question. I'm allowed to ask some questions, okay? Here's the question. I wonder if some of the things that are troubling in our life may not have to come if we lived a little more of a God-focused life. Sometimes I wonder if it's just sent in because we're not paying much attention. We're focused on other things, and maybe God just has to sort of knock on our heart's door to get our attention again. Now, God will do whatever He does. The reason He does whatever He does, understood. And sometimes we are God-focused, and still trouble can come into our lives, okay? Sometimes it's just a challenge, it's test us, and we live in a fallen world. But it's well worth thinking that way to say, maybe there's a reason God has to reteach me this lesson, and it's one that I could avoid if I pay a little more attention. So he's lost 22 of 32,000 total, but he still has 10,000 left. That's a large army. That's a large group of people. But we're not done, and you know the rest of the story, don't you? Verse 4. "Then the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people are still too many.'" How do you think he felt at that point? "Oh, we've got 10,000 left. At least we got a good number." "Nope, too many. Stop. Too many. We've got to get rid of some more of them." I mean, it's almost, if it weren't for God being involved, it would sound absurd. But you understand, this battle is going to be no problem for God. After all, he's brought this to bear so that they would know something about him. That's the reason the Midianites showed up to begin with. By the way, I should just tell you about the Midianites. I meant to tell you a little bit about that earlier, and I'll just do it now. But the descendants of Midian come as related to them, in essence. You remember it's in Genesis chapter 25, we're told that Sarah died two chapters earlier. Abraham is still alive, and it says he took another wife by the name of Keturah. Okay? Now, Israel, you know, Isaac, Jacob, sons of Jacob, Israel, all that sort of thing, came through Sarah and Abraham. That was the promise. He has this other wife that he marries. It sounds like in 25 he married her after Sarah died. But it's from this particular one, Keturah is her name, we meet her in 25, 1 and 2 of Genesis, that comes this line of the Midianites. They apparently lived in the sort of the east country, kind of in the Arabian Peninsula down in there. And we've run into them a few other times in Scripture. You remember in Exodus, when Moses fled from Pharaoh, he goes out and dwells in the land of Midian. He meets a man who is described as a priest of Midian. Remember his name? Jethro. And he marries one of Jethro's daughters as a wife. So, you know, you have this intersection of the two. Next time we meet the Midianites is when Moses is leading the people through the land. And this comes from the book of Numbers. And as this is going on, they were encamped in the plains of Moab. And it says the elders of Midian and a Moabite king kind of come together. So it's sort of that same people group. And the Moabite king hires Balaam, who apparently was a Midianite, to come and curse the people. And remember, we've talked about him in recent days. I sometimes get confused. Was it last Sunday night or Wednesday when I was teaching? It all kind of gets together in my mind. But that's the one that Balaam was the one his donkey talked to him, and all that. Every time he went to curse Israel, blessings poured out and so forth. So we see them, and this is basically the third time we reach the Midian. We hear the Midianites when they reach into this story. So that's who they were. We don't know exactly where they were, and one of the things you gather from the text is they were marauding bands. Okay, they were sort of like just the groups that would come in. They come into Israel. You saw that back in chapter 6 and so forth. They'd come in, do their business, tear up things, wreak havoc, steal your stuff, and then they'd go back. And they apparently traveled on camelback, or at least they had lots of camels, so they could move in and whatever. There's one other place, the Midianites, I just remembered, I should have told you. Another place we run into the Midianites. You remember when Joseph's brothers ganged up on him, and they threw him in a pit, and they were going to kill him, and they decided, nope, let's have plan B. Let's sell him in slavery. And there was a band of Midianite travelers or a caravan traveling down to Egypt to do trading. They sell him to the Midianites, and that's how Joseph got to Egypt, and you know the rest of that story. So there's one more. I should have mentioned that. Okay, so that's who the Midianites are. So he's going up against them, and he says there's still too many. He says this in verse 4. The people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test for you there. Then it will be that To whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, and the same shall go with you. And of whoever I say to you, this one shall not go with you, the same shall not go. So we're going to bring these 10,000 in, and we're going to give you a sign to show you who's in and who's out. Who gets to go home, who gets to join the battle, if you will. And then we have this rather interesting thing where he tells how he did it. Verse 5. So he brought the people down to the water. And the Lord said to Gideon, everyone who laps from the water with his tongue, as a dog laps, you will set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink. Most of us probably haven't spent too much time drinking out of a creek. Maybe some of us in earlier days maybe tried that. I wouldn't recommend it for health reasons. But nonetheless, if you were a group of people in that day and needed something to drink, that was about the only source of water, so that's what they did. And there's two ways you could do it. You could just stick your mouth in the water and just like that. Or you can dip it out with your hand and, you know, do it that way. So that's the dividing line. So it says this. So the Lord said to Gideon, verse 6, and the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300, but all the rest of the people got down on their knees, stuck their face in to drink the water. So if you were a lapper or a non-lapper, decided if you were going to be in the battle or not. Now, I've heard people say, I remember a pastor friend of mine long years ago, we were teaching this, and he said this. Now, I'm going to throw out some stuff because I really don't know. It might have just been God says, I'm just going to give you something random to you that's going to determine how many we have because God knew how many would be doing which. Maybe that's it. But I remember my friend said, well, the people who didn't stick their face in the water were more alert. They had their eyes on the battlefield. You know, they were. That's who you want to go in the battlefield. Someone that doesn't just get so distracted by getting a drink that they're not going to watch what's going on. I thought, well, that makes a lot of sense. Until I also heard another preacher say to me one time, he said, well, you know what that means? Those were so fearful that they had to keep their eyes out. It was not a sign of being aware. It was a sign of fear. So God wanted to send those that were the least likely soldiers into the battle. And I've heard all other sorts of things, but I don't really know. Can I confess that and you not be mad at me? I don't know. There's nothing in the text that sort of indicates which it is. And maybe there's no meaning there, but God says we're to get it whittled down. So now we're down to 300. And if we started with 32,000 and we're down to 300, if my math is correct, and I wouldn't swear that it is, my math is not good, that would be less than 1%. Is that correct? Because 320 would be 1%. And we're down to 300. So we're slightly less than 1% of where they started with is who is going to go into battle. Why? Because it's right there in the text. Verse number 2, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, mine own hand has saved me. So in essence, he wants to make sure that everybody knows that this is the way it is. Now, there's one more thing that has to take place before the battle. And that actually will actually pick up in verse 15. The story of the battle itself is rather small. Rather short. So we're down to 300. Verse 7. The Lord said to Gideon, by the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hands, lest all the people, the other people go, every man to his place. Notice how God says this in verse 7. By the 300 men who lapped, I will save you. It's not they will save you, or they will save Israel, or you all together are going to save Israel. God is very direct and very specific. That's what's going to happen on the battlefield is his doing. It's not going to, he doesn't want to share the credit because there's no credit to share with anybody else but himself. And God's going to receive the glory, and he's setting it up that way. And the people took provisions, this is verse 8, so the people took provisions and their trumpets in their hands, and he sent all the rest of Israel, everyone, every man to his tent, and retained those 300 men. Now the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. So we got this hill. Midianites are over there. God has one more thing to do. Now it happened the same night, verse 9, that the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have delivered it into your hand. Notice again, how many times is God going to say this? I've done this. I'm going to do this. This is me. This is me. This is on me. I'll make sure that no one's going to think that you're strong enough to do this. But if you're afraid to go down, go to the camp with Purah, your servant. He says, I want you to go down. I want you to go spy out the camp of the Midianites at nighttime. I can understand why you might be a little reluctant to do that. He says, if you're afraid to go, take your servant with you. And you go. You don't have to go alone. You go with him. And you shall hear what they say, and afterward your hands shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. And he went down with Purah, his servant, to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. He chooses option number 2. Did you get that? If you're afraid, take this guy with you. I choose option number 2. I'm sure I would too. I think we all probably would. So you're going to sneak in, and something interesting happens. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites, so there's a confederation, all the people of the east, and apparently the Midianites and the Amalekites sort of mixed together and raided together, were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts. Now, think of a locust plague, and as locust plagues would happen in that part of the world, as a swarm of locusts would come in, they would absolutely cover the ground, cover the trees, and just swarm until there was nothing green left. Every leaf off every tree, every blade of grass, all the vegetation just totally removed, just covering land like a blanket. That's how he describes them. And their camels were without number, as the sand by the seashore in multitude. Some of you are now on the second day of winter, or thinking about your next trip down to the beach and the warm breezes and the palm trees. Here's your assignment. Next time you go there and you see all that sand out there, go back to the story and be reminded, all right? I'm giving you a little assignment to take with you on vacation whenever you head to the beach, if you're a beach person, okay? So he says, as numerous as the sand. So it's just swarming the land. This is interesting as well, 13. And when Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. What's the thing he hears? Hey, I had a dream. What? It's just the whole story is it's humorous. It's actually sort of entertaining. And he said, I have had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian. And it came to a tent and struck it so that it fell and overturned and the tent collapsed. Now, I've had some strange dreams before, but I've never dreamed about barley loaves that I know of. And it's tumbling down the hill and hits a tent and just smashes the tent. Now, there's something that we need to think about back from chapter 6. They would come into Israel at the time of the harvest when, you know, you've planted your crops, you've got them growing, you're just about ready to get a return on your investment of labor and money, and suddenly here come the Midianites and all their camels and all their swarms, and they would just come in and destroy the harvest. The most important harvest agriculturally for Israel was the barley harvest. If that one didn't come in, it was going to be bad, bad news. That was their primary grain. In fact, right after Passover is the feast of first fruits, where they would bring the first of their grain offering, the barley harvest, in. When Jesus fed the 5,000 with the fish and the loaves, those loaves were more than likely barley loaves. That's what they ate. In fact, that was kind of a low person's diet, okay? This was not what sophisticated, wealthy people would be eating. They'd eat something a little higher up the food chain. So I think that's probably a derogatory way in his mind of probably what they called Israel. Maybe that was their insult. Those are the barley eaters, eating his barley loaves. And I think probably in their mind, that's why they catch this dream is about Israel. And notice the interpretation. Then his companion answered and said, now, this has got to be a God thing, because I don't know how he got this out of this dream, but here's what he says. This is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. Into his hand God has delivered Midian and the whole camp. What's your dream mean? What's that barley loaf? Smash the tent. We're doomed. And Gideon's going to do it, and Israel's going to defeat us. And suddenly, Gideon hears this, and he understands something about the mindset of this vast throng of Midianite soldiers. They're already afraid. God's already somehow instilled fear into them, and they're expecting to be defeated. Now, whether that dream was about that, or that's just a way of revealing what they were thinking, and that's kind of where you go when you're thinking, God's behind it all. Verse 14, then his companion answered and said, verse 15. And so it was when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation that he worshiped. Now, I want to just give you a few quick things to help us understand how we can make sure that we keep ourselves with our focus on God and not ourselves. And I need this reminder. And I'm glad that even though I wasn't planning on sharing this tonight, I'm glad the Lord kind of forced me into it, because I think this is what I needed to be reminded of. And I think we all do. So, how do we make sure that we experience God's victory, move away from just focus on what we can do or what we can't do, our strength, our liabilities, whatever it is, and we focus on Him in life? Number one, we need to move from an obsession of our own deficiency to His sufficiency. And notice this happens right here when it says, when Gideon, verse 15, when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, then he worshiped. He doesn't grab his sword. He doesn't immediately go back to camp. The first thing he does, he stops and worships God. Now, I don't know what exactly he does. Maybe he sang a psalm. Maybe he prayed. I think he probably got down face first on his face before the Lord and just said something to God significant. I think he praised God. That's how I pictured it. But he takes time to worship. So how do we make sure that we don't focus on our own deficiencies, our own flaws, our own faults? And that's so easy to do. Some of us are experts at beating ourselves up about everything. We assume everything's our fault and everything that's wrong I caused, and I'm never going to get ahead, and I'm just, you know, just mark me in the loser category. Some of us just kind of, our enemy loves to push us in that direction. So we need to just do what? Well, let's do what Gideon did. Let's make sure we worship. We need to encounter God regularly. We need to just, that's why being in church consistently like you are tonight is so important. We just kind of need to reset our thinking that sometimes gets so disarranged through all the stuff we hear and all the things we encounter in life and our own feelings and our own thoughts and our own history and our own people we're around and the world we live in. We just need to come back to this place and just stop for a moment and think about God. Worship God. Encounter Him regularly. And then do that in sincerity. Worship Him sincerely. There's no one except his servant with him. There's no show here. There's no like, okay, everybody, army, I'm going to worship. I don't want you to. He's all alone. He just worships God out of the sincerity of his heart. And he does that as an actual act of worship. And especially at this Christmas season, we have this opportunity just to worship him in a special way. So look at verse 16. I should read all of 15. I stopped short there. He worshiped. He returned to the camp, middle of 15, the camp of Israel, and said, "Arise, for the Lord has delivered the camp of Midian into your hand." They didn't wait till morning. They didn't wait till they got a plan. He tells everybody to get up. We're going to battle right now, right here. Secondly, he moved from his paralysis of fear to making some progress in faith. He finally gets it. I've worshiped God. I've come to this place that I realize the victory belongs to the Lord, and I'm going to now march into the battlefield. Yeah, it's thousands to 300. It's trained armies against a ragtag bunch of guys. It's all their camels against us on foot, but we're going to go forward. We're going to move forward to take that step of faith. By the way, I find it just fascinating that it follows worship. But there's a couple things I just suggest to you from the text that we see here. If we're going to move forward in faith rather than just being paralyzed in our own fear, we need to identify this. We need to sense where God is working, and that's where you go. You sense where God's working, let that lead you along. He hears this dream story and the interpretation story and suddenly realizes, God is at work here. Now I see it. Now, thank you, Lord. I know why I've been sent on this spy mission to hear these things. Thank you that you've let me hear what they're thinking and what they're feeling and what you're going to do, and I sense you at work. And when you get that sense of God being at work, it pushes you on. And sometimes we're very bad about sensing where God's at work because we forget to look for it. We forget to listen for it. And there's a reason this story's in the Bible. It's to remind us that we need to make sure that everything we do in His strength, His sufficiency, not our own, and we move forward in faith. And then when you see where God is leading, get there and also stay there. He's ready for battle from here on out. And then he does something very interesting. He divided the 300 men into three companies. I'm not sure that's great military strategy. There's only 300 of us, so let's divide into even smaller groups and let's march into the battlefield. It's commonly thought, and we don't know exactly how this has took place, but there's a thought that 100 went over Mount Moriah, and one went around this side and the other went around this side. So when they wake up, there's soldiers above them coming down, there's soldiers left and right as they face them in battle. So it's dispersing them for a purpose, all right? Part of which is to show God's at work, all right? So he put a trumpet in every man's hand with empty pitchers and torches inside the pitchers. Question, if you're a military guy, what's wrong with that picture? What's he loaded them up with? Got a trumpet, and then I've got empty pitchers, and I've got torches inside my pitchers. I've already used up all the hands I have. Right? There's no sword there. There's no shield there. Now, they probably had a sword tucked away. I understand that. But they're going to charge in the battle with what? A trumpet and a pitcher with a torch. Kind of seems unorthodox. I doubt if they teach this as a practical way to do battle at West Point. Do you? I don't know, but I suspect this doesn't make any sense. And this is number three. We need to avoid just the methods of man and adopt the ways of God. And sometimes the ways of God is way out of the norm of what we would expect. And have you ever noticed, if you've experienced this, you're praying about something, you're seeking to do something for the Lord, and you're asking something, and sometimes, you ever do this? We tell God what we would like and what we'd ask, and then in our own mind, we kind of figure out how God could pull this off. We kind of like just go ahead and put the strategy in place in our mind. Well, Lord, you could do this, and you can move that person to do this and say this, and this could provide this. And if you move all those chess pieces around, we're going to win the victory. Have you ever noticed if you ever do that, the chess pieces never move around the way you imagined it? Because God is just on a different plane, a different level. And he's moving this to play there. You know, just remind you of this. What makes sense to us in our practicality, our common sense, our intellect, sometimes it fails to work, especially if God is not leading us along. And sometimes what doesn't make sense is really God's leading. Now, I'm not saying just choose the stupid thing or choose the crazy thing, but if you follow God's leading, sometimes he's going to lead you to do things that really just don't make a lot of sense. So you remember that and be watching for that. So let's get back into our story. He's going to give some instructions. Now, verse 17, he said to them, "Look at me and do likewise. Watch. And when I come to the edge of the camp, ye shall do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, and I blow, and all who are with me, then you also blow the trumpets on every side of the whole camp and say, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. So, trumpet blast all around. This is the beginning of surround sound. Okay, this is when this was invented all those years ago. It goes all the way around them. And then blow the trumpet and then make this shout. Now, here's where we're going to give Gideon a grade. He says, here's what you're supposed to say. The sword of the Lord and of Gideon. Now, I'm not going to judge Gideon. He did far greater things than I could ever imagine. But was it necessary to say and of Gideon? Maybe God laid that on his heart and that's a proper thing. Maybe because they, when they heard the word Gideon, because remember, Gideon was mentioned earlier in the text. So maybe that was part of the strategy. And I just say this, it's just maybe, I don't know. But maybe he's now still fighting against that, trying to get some recognition for himself. Maybe not. So I'm not going to fully answer that question. I just throw that in. You can mark him down for whatever grade you want. Okay? So they're going to do that, and then we're not quite finished. Every side, and say, sword of the Lord to Gideon. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outpost of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. By the way, that's pretty much around midnight, okay, the middle watch of the night. So most of the soldiers are asleep. There's obviously some still standing guard. Just as they had posted the watch, they blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers that were in their hands. And the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers in their hands and held the torches in their left hands and trumpets in their right hands for blowing. And they cried, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. So there's a lot of noise, a lot of light, a lot of confusion. And part of the thing that they would have assumed, if an army is coming at us, not everybody's going to have a trumpet. So it's going to be one trumpet for so many guys. Now everybody's going to have a torch. It's one torch for so many guys. Now, I don't know what they would have assumed, but they assumed there's a lot more than 300 coming our way. And by the way, if we flee this way, we're in trouble. I hear them over there. If we flee this way, there's trouble over there. I hear them over there. If we try to go up the side of the mountain, it's trouble because they're there. And there's this vast plain, this Jezreel Valley, where it's open, flat territory. So there's no cover, no place to hide. They feel like they're in trouble. And here's what happens. So they blew their trumpets and they shouted, verse 21, and every man stood in his place all around the camp, and the whole army ran and cried out and fled. And the 300 blew the trumpets, and the Lord set every man's sword against his companion throughout the whole camp, and the army fled to Beth Acacia towards Zerah, as far as the border of Abel, Mahola, and Tebeth. So basically, they hear the sound, everybody grabs their sword, they're afraid, they start fighting. And if you run this way and you run into a bunch of your own men running this way, you assume that's the enemy, you start fighting them. You run to the opposite way, you run into a bunch of men from your own men that are running this way, and they're basically slaughtering each other in this, we would call that friendly fire today. And it says in verse 23, the men of Israel gathered together at Naphtali, from Naphtali to Asher and Manasseh, and pursued the Midianites. And it talks in those next verses about the destruction that has upon them. And then we get into chapter 8. It's peace for a long time. The Midianites are subdued. So just one more thing, and this is simply this. Make sure we reject praise for self and instead offer it to God. We need to take that back to God. And indeed, God received a great victory. And if you go down to verse 3 of chapter 8, it says, God has delivered you into your hands. And he mentions who was delivered. So in this speech that he makes later in chapter 8, he's giving God the credit for this great victory that took place. So, how do you fight battles God's way? How do you find victory? We just need to always be pushing back on the danger of thinking that either I'm able or I'm unable. Both of them are not true. Am I able? No. Are you unable? No. With God's help, you're not. So to focus on Him. Move from obsession to our deficiency to His sufficiency. Move from paralysis of fear to progress in faith. Avoid the methods of men. Make sure you adopt the methods of God. And fourthly, reject praise for self and offer to Him. And some of the things we do is learn from our past failures and learn from the victories that God wants to give us even now. Simple question. Very simple question. Are you fighting your battles God's way? This is a good reminder to me. I hope it's a good reminder to you. I'd rather we not have any battles, but I know enough about life that they do come. And we need to lean on Him.